My growing senior moments. I seem to have misplaced them temporarily. My name is Clark Murdoch. I'm the director of the Project on Nuclear Issues. Many of you are members of PONY. This is a program that started in 2003 with the intention of creating a network community of young professionals that would meet and interact with each other and cross-fertilize and add new thinking to nuclear issues at this time. We now have over 600 members. They're not all of them young. I'm actually an official PONY member, and there's nothing young about me at all during that time, but it's been a great success. And one of the things that we've come to realize within PONY, that even though the initial focus had been on U.S. nuclear strategy, policy, force structure, force posture, capabilities, that they're in the environment that we're in, the political environment, the policy environment we're in today, that you can't address just the U.S. issues with respect to its own nuclear capabilities without also addressing the important international dimensions of nuclear proliferation, of arms control, and of disarmament now, ever since the Quartet op-ed of January of 2007. So the scope of the issues that PONY has been addressing has expanded. And as we've been thinking more and more about nuclear proliferation, Jennifer, my colleague here at CSIS, has been pressing us to start bringing in other people with different perspectives into what is largely a U.S. and U.K. enterprise, and encouraged us to ask Ambassador Fahmy, who I'm pleased to say is accepted, to come and talk to us about nuclear proliferation from his perspective. He has been the Egyptian ambassador to the United States since 1999, and I'm not sure if that's a blessing or a punishment, but that's an awful long time. And before that, he was an ambassador to Japan and has been a political advisor of the foreign minister. But he is extremely well-schooled in these matters and extremely experienced, and I look very much forward to his comments. A welcome to Ambassador Fahmy, please.
Thank you very much. I'm honored to be at CSIS and to share with you my thoughts about what I've always felt to be a very important and urgent subject. I think many people share the point of view that it is important. Very few feel it's urgent. But, we need to address that. I've been asked to share with you a perspective from the Middle East. And since most of the talk about proliferation and arms control in the nuclear dimension has been about the Middle East over the last couple of months, let me first focus on that, and then maybe as I close, I'll say a few words about what I think the world should do about disarmament, nuclear disarmament, that is, if I remember. First, some historical context. The proliferation problems in the Middle East, whether they are nuclear or weapons of mass destruction, did not start with the present debate about Iran. They didn't actually even start with the debate about Iraq, be that before the most recent situation in Iraq or previously when Iraq invaded Kuwait. The debate and the discussion actually started in the 60s. And it was about whether Egypt and Israel would pursue nuclear weapons programs. At the time, the world was also discussing the Non-Proliferation Treaty, negotiating the treaty at the time. And ultimately, when the treaty was open for signature in 1968, Egypt signed the treaty, but decided to freeze its ratification of the treaty up until Israel decided to take a similar step. And we're still waiting. The next point that I'd like to refer to in that context is from the late 60s, right after the October War in 1973, rumblings were the same. What is Israel doing? What is Egypt's intentions? And then in 1974, Iran and ultimately, very quickly with it, Egypt, suggested, sponsored an initiative to establish a zone free of all nuclear weapons in the Middle East. 74, we can go on to a number of years to the Arab-Israeli peace process, or at least the Egyptian-Israeli peace process, and all the way up to the Madrid conference. And during that period, the debate expanded. It wasn't only Egypt-Israel anymore. It was also Egypt-Israel-Iran. And then Egypt-Israel-Iran and Iraq. And I would note that in the case of Israel and Iran, the nuclear capacity established therein came from France and the UK, respectively. You add to that then the Iraqi situation, and you have a more diverse foundation for their program. Anyway, as we went, we moved towards the, just before the Madrid Peace Conference, we had the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait, and in conjunction, just before that, we had an exchange of threats between Prime Minister Shamir and President Saddam Hussein about destroying each other, and we consequently submitted another initiative, we in Egypt, to rather than simply establish a zone free of nuclear weapons in the Middle East, to try to establish a zone free of all weapons of mass destruction and their means of delivery in the Middle East. We submitted that proposal in April 1991. The objective, or the logic behind that, was if the Arabs are serious about their concern for nuclear weapons, concern about nuclear weapons, particularly Israel's acquisition of nuclear weapons, and the Israelis are serious about their concern about the possible acquisition of chemical and biological weapons or missile capacity in the Arab world, if we could put together a package that balanced the concerns and the needs of both sides, we may get the two sides to look at this a bit more seriously. And we submitted that proposal in April 1991. It was extremely well received, but very little of it has actually been implemented. After the Madrid Peace Conference, or in conjunction with the Madrid Peace Conference, we had what we call the ACRS process, the Arms Control and Region Security process, which had most of the Arab world, except for Syria and Iraq. It had Israel, of course, at the same time. It did not have Iran as part of that process. And our discussions there, which went on for a number of years, were not really about nuclear or, for that matter, conventional, but were ultimately our discussions, and let me rephrase that, our posturing, the different delegates, was about their perception of what was actually happening about the, in the Middle East, what the Middle East actually was, and what the different vision was of the Middle East. I'll give you one example. We in Egypt had been at peace with everybody in the Middle East for longer than anybody else, and we were actually the only country that have had long-standing peace with Israel at the time. So we were looking at the Middle East that had arms control and security measures that was at peace with itself. Our vision was one that countries at peace, what would they need and what would they not need? The Israelis, of course, were still at war with some of the Arab countries in the Middle East, and Syria was absent from the multilaterals, as was, of course, Iran. So they had in their mind worst-case scenarios about what happens if. And that was the fundamental problem, that we were trying to define security measures for two different regions, one which was completely at peace and one which was still at war with each other. If you apply that to nuclear weapons of mass destruction, conventional weapons, confidence-building measures, and you see all of the basic problems. Our approach was equal security for all at lower levels of armament, the Israeli approach was qualitative and quantitative advantage over all of its neighbors because it was still living in a state of conflict. And you can't achieve progress in that perspective. Now, as you move on the forward in the calendar, you get to the Non-Proliferation Treaty Extension Conference, which is also a very important point to take into account here. In 1995, at the indefinite extension of the NPT, the members of the NPT adopted a resolution calling for the establishment of a zone free of nuclear weapons of mass destruction in the Middle East. As one of the, I think there were three decisions taken at the conference, the extension itself, the Middle East resolution, and there was something else that was taken that I just forget what it was. But there was the only region in the world that was referred to precisely and was provided a specific resolution was the Middle East. And that was testimony, first of all, to the support that existed for establishing a zone free of nuclear weapons, free of weapons of mass destruction in the Middle East, but also of the fact that this region is going from bad to worse. And unless you dealt with that on an urgent basis, you were going to have a worse a situation that was developing more negatively as things went on. And frankly, it's proven to be true on both counts. If you look at where we were, as I said, in the 60s, it was about Egypt and Israel. Today, we've gone through Egypt, Israel, I mentioned Iraq in the past, Iran has been added to it, and Iran now has come back again to be an issue, and people are even talking about Syria. It only got worse, and it will only get worse. I would also mention one further point here, a point of reference. After the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait, the Security Council adopted a resolution 687, which in paragraph 14 of its text, of its content, actually said that the steps being taken by Iraq in terms of getting rid of their weapons of mass destruction are a step towards establishing a zone free of weapons of mass destruction throughout the Middle East. So not only is the objective of establishing such a zone an Egyptian commitment, it is our initiative, but it has been endorsed at the Security Council, it has been endorsed at the Non-Proliferation Treaty Review Conference, and it is, in our mindset at least, a norm that has been accepted but not been implemented in the non-proliferation process. And I say this because it's very important to take into account the perceptions and frustrations that countries in the region have as we deal with this issue. Now, I've mentioned the background of some of the efforts that have been taken in this area because it's important for you to understand that this didn't start yesterday. And it's not about Iran alone. It's a much more complicated and complex issue. The other reason I mention this is, at the end of the day, when countries determine what agreements they are going to commit to, they essentially, in terms of arms control, they essentially look at their security needs. They're defined by their security needs, not by economic needs, for example, but basically what serves their security. So if we don't generate an international system that provides more security for countries living in a region that is witnessing an arms race in this area, then you have to logically conclude that countries will decide to counterbalance whatever threats they face, be that by pursuing nuclear programs, be that by not pursuing arms control agreements, other agreements, or be that by pursuing other weapon systems to counterbalance what may or may not be a nuclear threat or that of weapons of mass destruction. A lot has been said recently about a nuclear renaissance in the Middle East, particularly because of the rise in oil prices and consequently a lot of statements being made about who wants to pursue nuclear power programs. And that has brought with it a lot of concerns about proliferation. First of all, for any serious practitioner, nuclear weapons programs do not tend to be based on peaceful nuclear power plants, but more on the activities done by in nuclear research reactors and the industries around them. So the direct link that is a bit silly, that anybody who wants to pursue a nuclear power program is a proliferation threat, frankly, is something that you need to look at a bit more carefully. Secondly, in the Middle East at least, all of the countries that have recently announced their desire to pursue nuclear power programs are actually members of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. In other words, the focus is being put here on card-carrying official members who are in full compliance to an international norm that we have all agreed upon, rather than those who are either in violation of their obligations or have not joined the Non-Proliferation Treaty at all. So in trying to deal with proliferation, we're actually trying to deal with those who are committed to non-proliferation rather than those who are not committed to non-proliferation. And that's, again, one of the reasons why we keep failing in this process. We attempt to deal with the easy problems, or what we perceive as the easy problems, rather than the real problems, and ultimately come and wonder late afterwards what the problem is. But let me take some specific examples. Egypt, for example. We announced an interest in pursuing nuclear power in the 80s and then stopped it because of Chernobyl. The reason then simply was economics. We have a growing population. We need to grow our economy, and we will need more energy. We've had the luxury of growing oil and gas reserves for over a decade. That is the oil reserves are decreasing. The gas reserves still are quite reasonable. And we have once again announced an interest in pursuing a peaceful nuclear power program, which we're considering very seriously. The motivation is simply economics. We are committed in a unwavering manner to our non-proliferation obligations in the NPT, and that's what will govern this program. Another example being put out there is Iran. What should the world do? What is the nuclear program in Iran, and what should the world do regarding that program? What it is still a question mark. Iran is a member of the NPT. It is in close consultations with the IAEA regarding discrepancies in its application of its safeguard agreement. It, up to a point, seemed to respond to all of the IAEA's questions except for the issue of weaponization. And on that issue, they have not been completely responsive to the IAEA's questions, and most recently the IAEA expresses serious concern regarding the lack of full answers to some of the questions regarding weaponization. That being said, the IAEA also said that it had no evidence that nuclear material had been diverted to weapons purposes. But it's a serious question here. Why did it take Iran so long to respond to these questions? Some have even raised an issue about, does Syria have intentions to pursue a nuclear program? And Israel took it upon itself to destroy a facility in Syria because it felt that it had the right to do that because of concerns it had regarding the program. Well, let me comment on these last two developments. Actually, on all three. If the international community is concerned about enrichment and reprocessing that might relate to programs like those of Egypt, which are peaceful, safeguarded programs. I think it's important to take into account that rather than focusing on trying to apply more stringent conditions on our programs, because we are compliant with our safeguard obligations, it's important to focus on our motivation for enrichment or not. In other words, rather than trying to convince us to join the additional protocol, which we are not obliged to do, I would focus on whether you can provide assurances of fuel supply that would be sustainable, not tied to political links, not be at the whimsical changes of the political tides that exist worldwide, assurances of supply that would be guaranteed and provide on a sustained basis, that would provide us with the choice as compliant NPT members of deciding whether or not to enrich and reprocess or to have the fuel cycle from another source, the fuel from another source. I find the debate about restrictive, more intrusive practices illogical, unuseful, and ineffective. People who want, countries that want to cheat, won't be bound by the procedures. It will be more difficult, of course, if you have verification procedures. But rather than punishing those who have not cheated, it's important to actually try to provide motivation for them to pursue international norms that are consistent with what's available there and without raising concerns for others. But don't waste your time on trying to impinge on people's rights, especially countries that have fulfilled their obligations. Now, the other example, which is Iran. There's a question mark about why did it take Iran so long to respond to the IAEA, and why haven't they responded fully? I'm not going to debate Iran's rights to the full fuel cycle. They have the right according to the NPT. And I say that point blank without any hesitation. But they have raised suspicions about their program because they have not been responsive in the short term to the IAEA. And because of that, I think what's important here is for Iran to accept to apply a unilateral cap on its enrichment process, or a moratorium, to be more precise, for a period of time in which it gets assured assurances of supply of nuclear fuel. And at the same time, we start dealing with further measures, because further political measures. Because frankly, given the suspicions that exist, and given the third case that is the fourth case, actually, that's out there that I have not mentioned, simply dealing with present-day circumstances is not going to be enough. When you deal with non-proliferation issues or nuclear power issues, this is a long-term project. It's not a short-term investment or a short-term problem you can deal with. Let me quickly deal with Syria, and then I will come back to what I think we need to do. Nobody really knows what was at that facility, at least nobody that I know, was at the facility that was attacked by Israel. And I understand that the Syrians and the IAEA have agreed to send a team down to try to verify or explain what was actually there. Until that occurs, I'm going to withhold judgment on what was at the facility. I think we've all learned the lesson of not jumping to making quick judgments about what exists or what does not exist. And I would not get drawn into doing that again. Needless to say, Syria, like anybody else, an NPT member is responsible to remain committed to its obligations within the NPT. But I look forward to the IAEA and Syria working this issue to verify what exactly was there. But there is another issue that relates to this. The idea that because a country is concerned about a certain facility, it makes up its own judgments, does not use the IAEA,
to verify whether this information is correct or not, ultimately will raise serious criticism about and questions about the credibility of the international norm and the international organization that we have all chosen to be the party that verifies whether countries are in are fulfilling their obligations or not. So, frankly, I think that the information that upon which countries acted should have been provided to the IAEA for the IAEA to verify whether this information was correct or not. Third point is the use of force. I cannot condone that any country simply decide by itself to use force to deal with what it perceives as a threat without going through the United Nations. There was no imminent threat. There was no attack that justified unilateral action by Israel against Syria. There may have been a concern about the program, but there are mechanisms for doing that. If we are to allow countries to unilaterally decide what they do, when to use force, even in the absence of imminent threats, then frankly, this is going to be complete chaos as we move forward. The fourth issue here, while it's important to look at situations, and I mentioned my own country because I can talk freely about it, where nuclear power is of interest and how to assure fuel supply. And it's important to deal with situations like Iran where there's been a question mark, and I say a question mark, not more, about their nuclear program. It's important to deal with the ambiguity and the ramifications of the measures that were taken regarding the Syrian example. None of these will be solvable or sustainable in the absence of dealing with the presence of an unsafeguarded nuclear program in the Middle East, which is Israel. All of the other steps are stopgap measures that ultimately will deal with temporary problems, but will not deal with the threat of proliferation in the Middle East. Whether Israel had the right not to join the NPT, I'm not questioning its right not to join, but given the fact that it has not joined the NPT and it has a nuclear program, it raises concerns that have ramifications throughout all of the Middle East. And let me apply that to, if you want, the Iranian example. I mentioned that we needed to have Iran agree to a cap on its enrichment procedures and in exchange for a fuel supply, assurance of fuel supply. But frankly, that's not going to be enough to satisfy concerns about is Iran or any other country trying to cheat. The only way to go beyond that is to actually have the intrusive verification systems which will even go beyond what exists at the International Atomic Energy Agency, to ensure to have better knowledge about what's happening throughout the Iranian system. And the only way to deal with that is, frankly, to deal with the regional security concerns that exist. The Iranians, understandably, will say, well, if you want to go beyond my international obligations, then you need to deal with my security concerns. And their regional security concerns regarding weapons of mass destruction, of course, will involve the Israeli program. So I look at the Israeli program, or the Israel being outside the NPT, as an obstacle, not as a reason for the Iranian program, but as an obstacle to resolving the Iranian program. Iran cannot and should not wait until we establish a zone free of nuclear weapons in the Middle East to clarify its position with the IAEA. I'm not arguing that. But at the end of the day, for all of us to be comfortable that there are no exceptions in our region, we need to have a regional solution to couple the international obligations that we have all taken upon ourselves. Now, some will argue that each country has its own circumstances, and it is true, every one of the Middle Eastern countries have at one point in time, actually, to me personally, said that they support the establishment of a zone free of nuclear weapons in the Middle East or one of weapons of mass destruction, even though we've had very little progress in implementing that. One example, again, the Israelis have said, we support this, but we can't do this in the absence of peace between Israel and the Arab world. I don't agree with that. I think that the nuclear proliferation, the existence of nuclear programs, is actually a source of concern throughout the Middle East and ultimately creates threats even to Israel. But I don't really see the contradiction between that and why we cannot actually negotiate the details of a zone. What would be the scope of the zone? Are we going to disallow explosions, for example, nuclear explosive devices, as exists in some cases, or not disallow them, as is in the Tlatelolco Treaty? What is the geographical scope of the zone? What are the verification systems? What do we add to what exists at the IEA? What did we learn from the South African example in terms of additional technical measures? All of these things have to be negotiated. It takes time to do that. The negotiations themselves create a confidence-building environment that people are serious about dealing with this. We can then negotiate what are the conditions for entry into force. In other words, negotiate the technical details of the zone and negotiate the conditions for entry into force, how many members of the region have to join before it enters into force, whether or not there has to be a state of peace between the states in the region, and if so, which states in the region, and so on and so forth. So this idea that we can act as local, international and local firemen, putting out nonproliferation problems here and there and think they won't pop up again, has proven historically to be wrong. And we're dealing today with problems that are more difficult than what existed many, many years ago. I want to close with just one or two further comments, and I will stop completely. Another problem we all face in the Middle East and worldwide is there's no real commitment to nuclear disarmament. We've become, if I may use the term again, I'm always a bit cautious about using this, but I'm always gone beyond what I should say anyway. We've become non-believers in nuclear disarmament. More often than not, the debate is, well, that's not realistic. We can't do this. You can't expect to look for the Middle East not to have nuclear weapons, or the superpowers, the permanent members, to get rid of their nuclear weapons. Well, if you look at whether it was the NPT or, for that matter, the very first General Assembly resolution at the UN, it was all about nuclear disarmament. That is what was envisaged as the objective, be that at the UN or at the NPT. And I would refer you to a recent article by Sandra Nunn, Dr. Henry Kissinger, Secretary Schultz, and Secretary Perry, none of whom, by the way, are naive idealists, who argued recently that it is time to pursue a process towards a nuclear-free world because the cost and benefits of continuing to have these weapons simply don't justify their continued existence. Be that because their existence per se leads to proliferation and many other different problems, and more often than not you're told that that one of the most important problems is nuclear terrorism, or because the reality is the technology will ultimately be transferred, and you can see quite a lot of it, frankly, just on the internet. Or thirdly, frankly, it's a different world. If you don't have a strong bipolar focus for the world, where most of the world is on, or at least what you thought was most of the world, was on one side or the other, a nuclear deterrent, be that Chinese, Russian, American, or for that matter Egyptian, against a small island in the Caribbean is, frankly, no use. Or, frankly, a small country in Africa is, frankly, no use. The cost of continuing to have these weapons, ultimately, on a longer perspective, is much greater to you, as nuclear weapon states, and to us, than that of pursuing a process where we gradually, but in a determined manner, get rid of nuclear weapons as a legitimate way of pursuing our self-defense. And I would argue that, and I will close with this because I have to give up time for questions, we need to start delegitimizing nuclear weapons as a means for ensuring security of states. And we need to apply one standard for all the countries around the world in terms of what rights and obligations they have. In moving those two principles operationally, we need to tailor the operative parts of the process to each region, focusing on the real security concerns of the states in the region. States who are pursuing or may think of pursuing weapon systems do not do that in the absence of their own perceptions regarding security. Whether you agree with them or not, you have to understand what security perceptions define states regionally in the most cases, because we're not all global states. And that's what's going to define what we do in the area of proliferation. Thank you very much for your time.
Take questions now?
Please.
When you ask a question, please state your name and affiliation.
Go ahead.
I have two questions dealing with Miles Pomper from Arms Control Today. I had some questions dealing with Egypt's nuclear energy program that you discussed, and particularly potential cooperation with the U.S. As you know, the U.S. has been seeking to enlist Egypt in its global nuclear energy partnership, and Egypt has not yet signed up. I'd like some explanation of why that is. And one thing the U.S. has been looking for in some of its nuclear cooperation agreements, for instance, with the UAE and has received, is a promise not to engage in enrichment and reprocessing as part of the agreement. Would Egypt be prepared to do that as part of a cooperation agreement with the U.S.?
Well, first of all, we look forward to having a very strong and constructive cooperation with the U.S. In this field. Our relations with the U.S. are quite diverse, and frankly, it makes sense to also cooperate with you in the nuclear area. And I would, needless to say, there's also the technology component that's important to us. That's the first part. Yes, we will engage the U.S. and see what we can do. Second part is we will not take upon ourselves any further obligations to do that. We are a full-fledged compliant member of the NPT. We are not in violation of any of our agreements. And consequently, we see no reason to take further legal obligations. That does not mean that we will necessarily choose to enrich if we are offered a better offer. That is what will determine our objectives. As I said, it's not forget about dealing with our rights. Our rights are well known. And we're not going to offer any more concessions in that respect. Focus on our motivations. Anything that provides us with a better answer than doing it locally, we will look at seriously. The reason why we will not add additional obligations on ourselves is, frankly, as I said recently in another forum, we've been asked to take the high road so often, and that would encourage others in our region to be cooperative. We're all alone up there, and there's no oxygen. So unless people get serious about nonproliferation in the Middle East, we've done our share, and when you guys get serious, we'll join you. Yes, Aaron?
Thank you for your very meticulous and balanced presentation. Thank you. I have two questions. First, you referred to a zone free of weapons of mass destruction, which obviously will require some kind of verification. And I have a hard time imagining how you verify that nations give up biological weapons. That's one question. I mean, every little test tube in everybody's basement. Second, you referred, I tried to count, but I lost count at least 10 times, to the NPT as a very important and serious issue, in which you signed, didn't ratify, didn't accept the additional protocols, but nevertheless, you're in full compliance. As I know you know, the NPT allows a country like North Korea to develop its nuclear facilities fully, then send a letter saying goodbye, and leave the treaty with all the toys intact. Why do you take it that seriously?
Well, I disagreed on some of the details. I never said serious. I said it was important. But actually, the NPT does not... No, it isn't. And secondly, North Korea actually... Excuse me, the NPT does not allow North Korea to violate the NPT and then withdraw with everything intact. The NPT, like any other, I'll use your word, serious agreement, in order to encourage countries to join, provides a legitimate way out if their national security concerns are violated. And you submit your position to, or notification to the Security Council to take that step seriously. So, again, countries that join treaties are obliged to respect their commitments to the treaties. However, unless you deal seriously with the security concerns in each region, countries will be torn between their obligations to the treaties and what are the real concerns that exist in their region. The NPT can't solve everything. Therefore, you have to have it as the foundation for the nonproliferation regime, but you also have to deal with the situation in each region. You can't simply say, well, we have the NPT, it's indefinitely extended, it solves all the problems, and therefore nothing else is going to happen. But, again, if you're a member, you have to fulfill your obligations. On the verification issues, we have said that we want to establish a zone free of all weapons of mass destruction in the Middle East, nuclear, chemical, biological, and missiles. It's impossible to put together one organization to verify all of that, of course. And you're correct in saying biological will be the most difficult to verify, and that's one of the reasons why there's no verification procedures for the biological agreement which exists. However, we envisage using the international foundations that exist, be they the NPT, the CWC, the BWC, non-proliferation agreements on missiles, and complementing them with steps on a regional basis as the means to verify this. Secondly, there's always a risk in verification procedures. There's no foolproof verification procedure that will give you 100% fulfillment. The reason why we think it is still verifiable is, well, with the kinds of intrusive measures we're looking at, we would feel that our assurances is our security is better served with that kind of verification procedure against surprise developments than in a situation today where there's no obligation on states in the region to restrict themselves. So if it's either or, I will take the light gray rather than the black. Please. Well, first of all, I mean, we were a member, Egypt was a member of the IAEA governing board when the Iranian file was sent to the Security Council. So we voted with the board at the time, with the U.S. and others. Our position on that is very consistent, and we do not apply double standards to anybody. There's no question about the concern. The difference, and here you're correct, is about the solution. Is the solution, because of the concern, force? Is it further sanctions? What kind of force? What kind of sanctions? Our position has always been there's no short-term solution. Even if you push, and you have the Iraqi example, if you push the Iraqi program further down the road, all that happened is it went underground and became more sophisticated. because of the use of force the first time against. So I don't think there's a lack of concern in the Arab world about the program. There's a different rhetoric. You're correct in saying that. But the difference really is okay, what do we do about it? Every time we say, well, okay, let's deal with Iran the same way we deal with everybody else, and that means also down the road dealing with the Israeli program, you're not particularly ready to do that. We're not suggesting give Iran a way out until we finish the Israeli program. But we are frustrated with every time there's a problem in the region, we can't deal with this. That is proliferation, excuse me. We can't deal with this because Israel refuses to deal with this problem, and many of her friends go along with that. Please.
Institute for Strategic Studies, I'm Barry Schweid of AP, said the concern over Iran's program is so strong that at least 13 Middle Eastern countries either announced new plans to explore atomic energy or revive pre-existing nuclear programs, and countries such as Saudi Arabia, Algeria, or Egypt could soon feel the need to match Iran's nuclear ambitions, whatever that means, nuclear ambitions. That suggests they've had a powerful impact. You question that they've even done anything legally wrong. And, of course, they say they're just interested in energy. Has this been exaggerated? And it seems the whole world is catching the fever of the Bush administration's anxiety, or state of anxiety. Is that right?
Well, there are a lot of questions there. Yeah, first of all, I didn't question that Iran did something wrong. Iran did violate its safeguard agreements and then slowly started to respond to the IAEA on that particular issue. So we are concerned about the program. We're also concerned about two things, why it took them so long to answer, and secondly, why they're not answering on the weaponization issue, which the IAEA has raised with them. So the concern exists there. Are you exaggerating or not? Look, I have to go by an objective standard. One, I share with you your concern. Secondly, the objective standard is the IEA. That's what will determine what we consider to be how far Iran has violated its obligations or not, and what is the nature of their program. But again, even if we solve this problem today to the full comfort of everybody involved, what would prevent it from reemerging in the future, be that in Iran or in another country? I mentioned to you from the very beginning, it started off with Egypt-Israel, then we ratified, then it went to Iraq, then Iran, then Iraq, then Iran again, and now people are talking about Syria. It will only get worse unless we establish a zone free of these weapons in the Middle East. And that's the only answer to this. The other point you mentioned, would we be concerned and would we look at having a nuclear program? I've read that report, and it's frankly rather superficial and historically incorrect, although I have tremendous regard for the institution itself. If you look at the Egyptian nuclear program in the 80s, when we announced we were looking for nuclear power, it was not an Iranian issue then. And we stopped, and we publicly said this, we stopped only because of our concerns about safety and environment after the Chernobyl accident. So we didn't come up with this nuclear program as a result of what's happening in Iran. If we were to announce a nuclear program today, start bidding for it today, we would finish establishing it 10 years from now. So it would not be a response to nonproliferation in Iran.
But if someone is committed to nonproliferation, I would think it would be disheartening that the impact of Iran's program seems to be to accelerate the drive for for nuclear programs, instead of accelerating the drive to deal with the issue, which you say is,
well, first of all, disheartened is a very diplomatic word to describe my frustration and my feeling regarding how this is being mishandled. Secondly, the last 2 years I've been sitting in my office Every couple of weeks, somebody from the nuclear industry knocks on my door wanting to sell us nuclear reactors. And then a week later, somebody from the proliferation industry knocks on the door and is concerned about what our program is going to be about. We're not the problem. The problem is the proliferators who are not NPT members or who are not committing themselves to the treaty. Unless we deal with the problem, you will have proliferation in our region. And if I have to determine how to secure myself, I will. Let's be very, very clear here. We have defined our security in terms of non-proliferation commitments. But others have to respect the same commitments. Again, you're looking at U.S. and U.K. as part of NATO, stemming proliferation within the NATO members. In other words, you provided a security answer to their concerns. Frankly, if we can provide a security answer to the concerns of the states in the region, we will have less problems of proliferation. Yes, of course. I would like to see peace in the Middle East. I would like to see regional security arrangements in the Middle East that will drive us all to pursue our security through conflict resolution, through negotiations at a lower level of armaments, everything we've been saying for a generation now. Yes, I think that's going to be useful. But in the meantime, what do we do? Until we get to that situation, what do we do? Do we simply say we push that ball down the road, and then we're going to come back and say, well, now we have four nuclear states in the region. How do we convince the four of them to dismantle what they're doing? Or to deal with weapons of mass destruction.
Well, the answer is preemptive. The United States comes in and says we will send our nuclear deterrent to a group of nations for protection. So they don't have to go down that road. So that gives you at least a basis.
I've heard that. How would you give the deterrent to two parties that actually were enemies and be trusted by both of them? Well, that's why I wouldn't leave it there. Yes. Look, as frustrated as I may appear, and I am, we always looked up, even when I started my career, to the U.S. and the Soviet Union at the time, and then also the three others that had nuclear weapons, to lead in this dimension. You're the ones who have the weapons. You're the ones who have used the weapons. You're the ones who have kept them as part of your deterrent policy. If you don't take the leading role in this, there's no real pressure on the proliferators on a regional level not to take a step further. The logic of your deterrent policy used regionally is a reason to pursue proliferation regionally. If you think nuclear weapons have helped you internationally, well, the same logic. Some country in the region wants a weapon that is so dominant over any other weapon that it will be a deterrent against its security vis-a-vis its other regional states, and then you sort of push that further down. I've heard also the argument that, well, let's establish a better nuclear weapon, and it's more effective, and therefore it is better deterrent. We've been saying that for 30 years, and that's been the logic of every generation of new weapon system. It doesn't help. The most effective way to move forward, and I would refer again, these are not four naive idealists, and I don't agree with everything they wrote, by the way. But you had four American statesmen saying it is time now to revisit the whole issue of nuclear weapons and nuclear deterrence because it is not cost-effective and the dangers are greater than
its benefits. And that's the rule I'd urge you to take. Pierce, you had a question?
Thanks, Paul. I thought I'd just go back for a second to your comment about the first thing we did in Wuhan, where you mentioned several decisions were taken. I think the one you were searching for was the set of commitments that you know were taken by the parties, including the Nicaraguan states, to advance.
Sure.
Sure. Well, I mean, Pierce, you're making a valid point. I think that if the U.S. takes the lead in pursuing global nuclear disarmament, it puts tremendous pressure on everybody else, whether they can be responsive or should be responsive to international obligations. You mentioned the CTBT. Presently, when people ask us, why don't you join another international agreement, but can't provide any answers. First of all, there's no real pressure to do it because nobody else is doing it. Nobody who is actually a threat is doing it. U.S., India, Israel, nobody's joining, so why? There's no real seriousness about that effort. Secondly, nobody's really trying to help us deal with our security concerns in our region. And consequently, why should we take another step? Let me share with you an anecdote, and I say to you very frankly, I support the CTBT, but I find it impossible for us to ratify as a country in the present environment. In our debates over the years about how best to get all of our region to join the NPT, once made the point to a very prominent American politician, but I won't name him because he's not in the room and it's not appropriate, trying to justify why Israel, Iran, and others should agree to establish such a zone. And I mentioned that, well, we did it. It's just fairness. And he said, well, who asked you to do it? You gave away the leverage by joining the NPT. The reality is we have made every possible commitment to nonproliferation that we can possibly make and see nothing in exchange. And we've made those commitments not because we're idealistic, but because we have felt those commitments enhance our security. If they don't result in that, then ultimately we have two choices. Either we don't make further commitments, and that's where we are now, or we go back on our old commitments, which is what we won't do. So there is a political inability to move forward because there is no seriousness in dealing with our regional security concerns. But I, think that the CTBT is one of the very important vehicles for moving disarmament forward. We just need to deal with the different ways to encourage countries to do that. Please.
If I could just take the opportunity... Given your rather pessimistic picture, then what do you have in view for the 2010 review conference of NPT?
Look, the NPT was meant to end. If you read the contents of the NPT carefully, it was supposed to lead to nuclear disarmament and a world of general and complete disarmament successfully. It was supposed to come to a successful end. We have now extended it indefinitely, which is illogical in terms of the whole logic of the treaty. If it continues to be illogical, where it goes on and the environment around it gets worse, it will be marginalized. I think that's a very dangerous consequence because it is a weak, it's not an unimportant treaty. It's weak in its results in problem areas. Numbers-wise, we can always say, yes, there are more countries joined now and they wouldn't have joined if it didn't exist. That's correct. They would not have joined if it didn't exist. And some very important countries with nuclear capacities chose not to join, not to become nuclear weapon states. However, it has not solved the problem cases. And unless we start dealing with that, the NPT more and more will become marginalized. And I dread that because I don't see a good alternative to it. Yes, please.
A couple of things. You talked a little bit about Syria in your question. But I was very struck by how little commentary there's both in the Arab world and worldwide about the attacks by Israel and the alleged reaction. Some seem to be a lot more accepted, say, the attack on Austria in 1981. Wondering what your thoughts on why that was. Also, as you know, the Blitz Commission last year suggested the idea of preventing sensitive nuclear facilities throughout the Middle East. There's a moratorium on that, and I was interested in that as some sort of interim step towards WFD.
Sure. The lack of Arab response. First of all, after the operation itself, nobody, the Syrians, the Israelis, the Americans, the IAEA, nobody actually announced what happened. The first time, people knew what happened. The Israelis had flown over and attacked a reactor. So the parties themselves, those are knowledgeable parties, remain silent. Secondly, the Middle East is going through regional turmoil. We have four or five major issues, major crises going on at the same time, be that the lack of progress in the Arab-Israeli conflict, the situation in Iraq, we had the situation in Lebanon. So it just, in the midst of all of that chaos, that may be another reason why you did not see a strong Arab reaction. But, and thirdly, frankly, we want to make sure, or we hope, that the IAEA and Syria will clarify what exactly existed there. The issue of sensitive facilities in or material in the Middle East, how is the question, not whether to prohibit it. If you ensure that this material and this technology is not existing in all of the Middle East by providing motivation for countries not to pursue it, I'm in agreement. If you try to apply it by applying restrictions, then you will cause them to question their commitments to international obligations because you are now violating them yourself. That was not part of the package on which they joined, for example, the NPT. So if you're going to start to put together new norms that impinge on people's rights, even though they haven't made commitments to these new conditions, you will ultimately cause them to read. I don't see why it could not be possible if they are motivated to do that. In other words, if that is a better package than trying to pursue the technology locally or to acquire it locally, why shouldn't we look at it? I'm completely open to whatever is good for our peaceful nuclear program. I would add, however, people use the word all the Middle East loosely. You're talking about prohibiting the sensitive material or technology from the NPT members in the Middle East, I assume, or all of them. Well, I'd be supportive of it. If you can get everybody in the Middle East to agree to anything, I'll support you. Yes. Sure. First of all, it's a matter of context. I've been asked to talk mostly about nuclear, so that's where I started. Secondly, at the Non-Proliferation Treaty, at the review conference, they have no mandate to discuss chemical or biological, so it doesn't make any sense really to focus there. Yes, we did use the term weapons of mass destruction free zone at the extension conference, and frankly, get me some serious partners to sit down and discuss it. I'll discuss weapons of mass destruction free zone. So, I mean, we're not shying away from that at all. It's just that it's more complicated. There are no serious takers. And we have shit. I mean, you very precisely monitor our position. We're now moving towards what is the actual responsibility of the NPT on this issue. It is not responsible to establish a zone free of weapons of mass destruction. But it adopted a resolution, and it is concerned with nuclear weapons. So unless, as partners, you want to get serious about this, then the whole treaty is brought into question here. And that's really what we're trying to focus on. Let's do something practical as players, as partners in the NPT. If you want to keep it on nuclear weapons, we'll do that. But we're not moving away from our proposal. That seems to be the list of questions. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very, very much. I'd like to thank Ambassador Fahmy on behalf of CSIS, and he will be leaving Washington soon. He's been here for quite a number of years, since 1999, as you heard, and he'll be going back on to attack these issues, I assume, when he gets back to Cairo. Thank you again, Ambassador.